read that. That was seen in story after story for decade after decade. Just this invisibility, as Mike's apology said, that we did nothing or little to change the narrative, the perception about who Black Americans, Black Kansas Cityans were.
Well, we will link to your whole series at democracynow.org. Murray Rose Williams, education writer at the Kansas City Star. Mike Fannin, president and editor of the Kansas City Star, which recently published an apology for the paper's racist history titled The Truth in Black and White, an apology from the Kansas City Star. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carlo Wills, and Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras, our general manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Dennis Moynihan.
Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. It's Wednesday. Stay tuned for more, the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your host, Paul Rowland, coming right up.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart.
And good morning, everybody out there in Radio Land, or whatever device you might be listening to this program on. I am your host, Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. We are still in our end of the year give guide moment, and we're still looking to raise some more funds to keep the station going. You can go to kboo.fm. and be directed to how to support this station financially. And of course, that's the main way you can do it, since our station is closed down to volunteers. There is still need for volunteers online doing various things. But anyway, just wanted to put that out there. We always appreciate your support. So at the end of the year, it's very traditional for radio and TV talk show people to talk about the look back at the year and look at its high points, low points, what was significant, meaningful. And we're going to be doing that, but it seems like a lot of people seem to want to just put 2020 quickly behind us and move on, which I don't deny. Though I haven't personally suffered the harsh effects like a lot of people have, especially more disadvantaged people, people of color, who, as you heard in the last slot with Amy Goodman, is going on at a higher rate than ever with the spike in COVID infections and deaths. Obviously, I have been cooped up in my house a lot like the rest of you, so I've certainly had to deal with that. But I think a lot of people, I don't know, I don't want to generalize, it's, it almost seems like it's kind of whistling as you're going past the graveyard, just sort of, let's get this over with and move on. But I want to look at 2020 as a year of reckoning that needs to be continued and taken further, a time of reckoning with deeply embedded systemic racism and historic injustice, with the fragility of our democratic institutions and the lurking specter of fascism behind them or within them, which is still present, of continued reckoning with patriarchy and sexual abuse, and with the increasingly obvious corruptions of a capitalist system incapable of dealing with the multiple intersecting crises besetting it, and which itself has largely caused. A fundamental part of that reckoning has to do with the continuing legacy of European colonization of this continent, which, along with the enslavement and forced labor of millions of Africans, set the stage for this grand experiment called the United States, which has turned out to be, in many ways, an even more virulent type of colonizing empire bent on extracting wealth and imposing domination both within and without. Hank Adams, who died last week at age 77, embodied the spirit of resistance to colonization and domination of the indigenous peoples of this continent. I'm going to read some articles about him and from the American Indian Movement's Trail of Broken Treaties 20-point position paper, which Adams drafted. And of course, I'm going to be taking your calls at 503-231-8187. So before I do that, we also lost Barry Lopez last week, and I just want to read a little bit from an article that was just published on December 24th entitled "Barry Lopez and an era of emergencies is upon us and we cannot look away. I object to the desecration of what is beautiful. I object to society's complacency. We've lived for generations in America with our promising tomorrows waiting for us just up ahead. Despite world wars and ceaseless warfare, despite backbreaking for some economic depressions and recessions, despite a history of slavery and genocide and being plagued by regular flare-ups of malfeasance and corruption in government, despite the oceans of filth and poison that hang menacingly in suspension in our air and water, we continue to believe in deliverance. We believe in the eventual triumph of liberal values, the passage and enforcement of equitable laws, comity in all our daily affairs, affordable education, probity from our politicians, the full embrace of which will allow us finally to dismantle entrenched bigotry and injustice. As I write these words, I'm compelled to say that I see no sign of such a salvation on the horizon. This is not to imply that the situation in the United States is hopeless, even considering the wealth gap, widespread environmental degradation, institutionalized cheating in business, the many biological and economic problems associated with advancing climate breakdown, and the social inequity created by, say, male privilege, but only to suggest that we have been kidding ourselves about there being just up ahead a clearer path to the other side of all this. Our children and grandchildren, seeing how tentative our response has been to global climate disorder and to whatever else might conceivably be coming along, the sudden collapse of an international financial institution like Deutsche Bank, or a pandemic for which there is no immediate cure, have framed already their objections. Why did you not prepare? Why were you so profligate while we still had a chance? Where was your wisdom? And that's just a couple paragraphs from the article just published a few days ago, Barry Lopez, "An Era of Emergencies is Upon Us, and We Cannot Look away. So, again, 503-231-8187 is the number to call in on. As I said, Hank Adams passed away last week. I don't know how many of you knew of Hank Adams and his work. I never knew him or met him personally. I had heard of his work. I hadn't followed it closely in the past 10 or 20 years, but I certainly was aware of it at the time when I was active myself with Native American support work, supporting treaty rights and cultural rights. So I'm just going to read a little bit from this article to give you a little better sense of who he was. Hank Adams was a nationally celebrated, this is from the Seattle Times 2 days ago, was a nationally celebrated historian and strategist who fought for the rights of American Indians in the Northwest and beyond. He died at Providence St. Peter Hospital in Olympia on December 21st following repeated bouts with illness, according to the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, which announced his death. He was 77. The historian Vine Deloria called Adams, quote, the most important Indian in the U.S. at the time because of his role in important actions and movements beginning in the 1960s for Indian sovereignty and civil rights. While he always sought to stay out of the spotlight, Adams was present at and helped shape many of the key historic events in Indian country over four decades, including the fishing wars in the Pacific Northwest. A generation of Indian fishing rights activists were jailed, fined, and beaten by Washington State game wardens as Native Americans first on the Nisqually River in Thurston County and then on the Puyallup fought to fish off the reservation, a right reserved in their treaties with the U.S. government. The fishings culminated in the 1974 decision by U.S. District Court Judge George Bolt affirming the tribe's reserve rights to half the catch. The case was brought by the United States against the state of Washington for its continued violation of the tribe's treaty rights. Adams was a crucial ally and strategist throughout the battle, both on the riverbanks and in the courtroom. He also negotiated peaceful ends to some of the most dangerous standoffs in modern Indian history, including negotiations with the Nixon White House to resolve the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, D.C. by tribal activists in 1972, and a 10-week siege of Wounded Knee, South Dakota in 1973. And I will just add as a parenthesis, yesterday was actually the 130th anniversary of the massacre of Wounded Knee, which is, of course, why that occupation of Wounded Knee and 10-week siege of the occupants happened in 1972. Either incident could have resulted in fatalities, but Adams was credited with a critical peacekeeping role. Willie Frank III, a member of the Nisqually Tribal Council, remembers growing up listening to Adams and his father, Billy Frank Jr., strategizing about the fish wars then underway at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River. You can't talk about my dad without talking about Hank, and you can't talk about Hank without talking about my dad, Frank said. They were pretty close. He was my dad's consultant in every major decision, Frank said of Adams. He was a strategist and part of every big Native American movement since the 1960s. He was the man behind the scenes. He was never the guy to be out front. A renowned historian and archivist, Adams amassed an important collection of historic photographs and papers. There was a little path through. The rest was books and papers and boxes of paper, Frank said. But you tell him you want to see a certain piece of paper, he could go right to it. I believe he was the smartest man in Indian country with his knowledge of history. In later years, Adams had a wide circle of friends with whom he shared photos and history on social media. Frank and others credited the work of civil and treaty rights warriors like Adams and his father for where Indian people are today in the Northwest and beyond. And this goes on for a few more paragraphs. I'll just go to the end. Born in Wolf Point, Montana, May 16, 1943, Henry Hank Lyle Adams was enrolled in the Assiniboine Sioux tribe. He moved to Washington State with his family after World War II, where he attended Moclips Aloha High School near the Quinault Indian Reservation. Editor Mark Trant reported in his obituary for Adams in Indian Country Today. It was in 1963 that Adams joined the National Indian Youth Council and began his long partnership fighting for treaty rights with Billy Frank and for indigenous sovereignty. I have a link to that Indian Country Today article on my program page at kboo.fm Wednesday Talk Radio. Again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. We're talking about the year that has been, 2020, which I call a year of reckoning. with massive nationwide Black Lives Matter protests, with the increasing activity of far-right white supremacist groups in allied with President Donald Trump, raising the fear amongst many, including myself, of possible fascist moves to engineer some kind of coup, which has become a kind of a slapstick at this point, but there still is danger. Trump is still trying to get something, protests at the January 6th ratification of the election in Congress. And who knows what other horrible moves, in addition to fast-tracking executions at the tail end of his administration in an unprecedented way, continuing to totally mishandle or intentionally mishandle the COVID crisis, leading to what we see now, when many people believe that an early and strongly federally managed response to the crisis would have curtailed many of the deaths and not led to such a massive economic shutdown. So yes, we are in a time of reckoning, as continue to have unprecedented superstorms from climate change. Who knows what next year is going to bring? The melting of the Arctic sea ice, and our institutions are seemingly incapable of responding, given the partisan deadlocks, the corruption at all levels, etc. But on the ground, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say hopeful, but signs of people really taking the sense of urgency from this fascist regime and from all the ramifications of the COVID pandemic. And I think that's been part of the spur for a lot of the upswelling. Obviously, the obvious images of many statues of colonizers and racists being taken down all around the country, Columbus and Confederate leaders, etc. That's a kind of definitely goes along with the theme of a time of reckoning. One thing, as I said, Hank Adams was a really important leader in Indian country, and he drafted this Trail of Broken Treaties 20-point position paper. Now, over the years I've been doing the show, I've been attempting to interview people and talk about subjects that try to get to some kind of, if not programmatic, at least some kind of a more deeper way of grappling with the cultural, economic, political crisis that's the legacy of colonization and slavery. And I think this 20-point position paper, along with other important documents, programs like the Black Panther 10-point program, I know the Port Huron statement, what became the Students for Democratic Society, and many others, obviously calls for reparations, dismantling the criminal injustice system, defund the police. These are very serious challenges to the system. I'd just like to read a little bit, because, as I said, in my opinion, we talk a lot about decolonization now, but what would it really mean in a, especially from an indigenous point of view, in terms of actually grappling with the institutional arrangements that were set up in consequence of the European colonization and the establishment of the United States as its own expansionist imperial power. So if anybody wants to call in, I'm ready to take your calls, but let me read a little bit from this, because I think it's really important. I don't think a lot of people know about this. It's from October 72, 1972, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Trail of Broken Treaties for Renewal of Contracts, Reconstruction of Indian Communities, and Securing an Indian Future in America. One, restoration of constitutional treaty-making authority. The U.S. president should propose by executive message, and the Congress should consider and enact legislation to repeal the provision in the 1871 Indian Appropriations Act, that which withdrew federal recognition from Indian tribes and nations as political entities, which could be contracted by treaties with the United States, in order that the president may resume the exercise of his full constitutional authority for acting in the matters of Indian affairs, and in order that Indian nations may represent their own interests in the manner and method envisioned and provided in the federal constitution. Now, before I continue, I'm sure Adams himself and whoever else was involved in this, and people who are active in indigenous advocacy and resistance in the United States right now, might change the emphasis, change the language, but this is a really interesting starting point. Two, establishment of treaty commission to make new treaties. The president should impanel and the Congress establish with it next year, in 1972 he's talking, a treaty commission to contract a security and assistance treaty of treaties with Indian people to negotiate a national commitment to the future of Indian people for the last quarter of the 20th century. Authority should be granted to allow tribes to contract by separate and individual treaty, multi-tribal or regional groupings or national collective respecting general or limited subject matter, and provide that no provisions of existing treaty agreements may be withdrawn or in any manner affected without the explicit consent and agreement of any particularly related Indian nation. Three, an address to the American people in joint sessions of Congress. The president and the leadership of Congress should make a commitment now and next January. This is actually very, very appropriate. To request and arrange for four Native Americans selected by Indian people at a future date, and the President of the United States and any designated U.S. Senators and representatives to address a joint session of Congress and the American people through national communications media regarding the Indian future within the American nation. Four, commission to review treaty commitments and violations. The president should immediately create a multilateral Indian and non-Indian commission to review domestic treaty commitments and complaints of chronic violations, and to recommend or act for corrective actions, including the imposition of mandatory sanctions or interim restraints upon violative activities, including formulation of legislation designed to protect the jeopardized Indian rights and eliminate the unending patterns of prohibitively complex lawsuits and legal defenses, which habitually have produced indecisive and intermittent results, only too frequently forming guidelines for more court battles. Of course, since then, there's been a whole body of Indian law that has in some ways attenuated that and in many ways not. Five, resubmission of unratified treaties to the Senate. The president should resubmit to the U.S. Senate of the next Congress those treaties negotiated with Indian nations or their representatives, but never heretofore ratified nor rendered moot by subsequent treaty contract with such Indians and having ratified treaties with the United States. The primary purpose to be served shall be that of restoring the rule of law to the relationships between such Indians and the United States, and resuming a recognition of rights controlled by treaty relations where the failure to ratify prior treaties operated to affirm the cessions and loss of title to Indian lands and territory, but failed to secure and protect the reservations of lands, rights, and resources reserved against cession. Anyway, there's a lot of intentionally formal and legal language here for obvious reasons, but may not make the best reading on radio. Plus, it's a very long document. I'm just going to maybe just read the titles of some of the subsequent ones. Six, all Indians to be governed by treaty relations. Seven, mandatory relief against treaty rights violations. Eight, judicial recognition of Indian right to interpret treaties. Nine, creation of Congressional Joint Committee on Reconstruction of Indian Relations. 10, land reform and restoration of a 110 million acre native land base. And it details that in four separate points. Revision of U.S. Code 163, restoration of rights to Indians terminated by enrollment and revocation of prohibitions against dual benefits. Repeal of state laws enacted under Public Law 280. It's incredibly visionary, this document. And again, subsequent policies, legislations, executive orders have to some extent changed this, but I think if there's anyone listening, especially Native Americans, who disagree with my interpretation, please call in, and I'd love to be corrected. I certainly don't know anywhere near about this as much as a lot of people, many people do, including maybe some people listening to this program. But I've never seen such a comprehensive document lying out the basic structure of how to respond to the institutional injustices and the systemic injustices, and the way it's codified in the legal structure of the United States from the Constitution on regarding indigenous people. So again, that's the Trail of Broken Treaties 20-point position paper drafted by Hank Adams. I don't know the whole story of it, but it came out of the 1972 occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs by the American Indian Movement and allies in 1972, and Hank Adams played a crucial role in both the occupation, its resolution, and again in this 20-point position paper, which would be interesting to see a current version of something like that. If anything's been done, anybody's thinking of doing it, I'd really like to hear about that. But those are some of the things I would like to talk about, how to further this time of reckoning that as Trump, COVID, continued systemic racism, the legacy of colonization and slavery and patriarchy and all the rest has, and the industrialization, the pouring of vast amounts of CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and other pollutants into our biosphere has set for us, which, I mean, 2020 has been a hard year, but this is a long time in the making, and it's going to be really difficult to undo. So I'm always looking for people, really clear-sighted people, who've laid out what now is popularly known as roadmaps to how to get ourselves out of the situation we're in. Obviously, the kind of on-the-streets direct actions that have been taking place all around the country, including Portland, are a fundamental part of it. They spurred, you know, dramatic changes, at least in the level of discussions, and in actuality, some actual, taking away funding from police department, reshifting priorities that at least the Black Lives Matter protests have done, and also the taking down of these virulent symbols of this system in the statues of Columbus and Confederate generals and such. But I'm just one voice here, and I would love to hear what you have to say about anything that I've brought up. 503-231-8187. I've also got a Facebook page, KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can like me on there. You can make a comment on there. And but please call up at 503-231-8187. I've also got some other articles about Hank Adams that I could refer to. This is from that Indian Country article. Hank Adams was prolific in every sense of the word. He was a genius who disappeared into stacks of documents and then reported the specific language defending a treaty or to build a case for justice. He then outlined a strategy to bring that research home in order to make the world better for Native Americans. I guess on that note, I'd like to give a shout out to all those other unheralded people who do the hard work, whether it's studying the financial system, like people here in Portland. Some of my previous co-hosts talked a lot about the way that rental speculation is skewing the housing market and helping set the stage, in addition to the COVID economic meltdown, to the eviction crisis that continues to beset us and is probably going to get even worse in the weeks, months, and the year ahead. All the research institutes that grind out the important data and documentation of unequal treatment in healthcare and all the rest that you hear on Democracy Now! And on KBOO. You know, there's people that are doing direct action on the ground. There's leaders calling for protests that are helping change policy. There's people who run for office who are changing the dynamics at that level. And there's the people who do the real difficult day-to-day grunt work of crunching numbers and compiling data of police abuse, of sexual abuse, and all the rest that is so important. And Hank Adams apparently was one of those people who was just always there behind the scenes. Adams once said, and this could describe himself, leadership is not the person who holds the office, but they're the leaders who act through the agency of others. He was instrumental in the success of the Bolt decision, which established a guaranteed 50% share of the anadromous fish, salmon, and others that entering the treaty fishing areas of the Puget Sound and its river and those rivers and the Columbia River and its tributaries. And resolving the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Wounded Knee, he chronicled and reshaped Indian policy and always pressed for the rights of Native people, especially those codified by treaty, in every major case that came before the Supreme Court or surfaced in public discourse. When the Supreme Court ruled in favor of tribes last year in the case Herrera versus Wyoming, a case that supported the right of the Crow tribe to hunt on unoccupied lands of the United States under an 1868 treaty, Adams wrote Indian Country Today included a 14-page review of treaty rights involving hunting and fishing cases. Adams was disappointed that the lawyers for the tribe did not press the case further because it did not obliterate a terrible precedent. Quote, the preferred and not most obvious result is for the court to directly overrule its 1896 immoral decision in Word versus Racehorse, he wrote. Herrera's lawyer nonetheless used his reserved time at end to say, we don't think you need to take the next step and expressly overrule the outcome in Racehorse. Then from the 1960s until his death this week, Adams was constantly reading, reviewing, and stirring ideas. A news release from the National Indian Fisheries reported the news. It is with a heavy heart that the family and close friends of Hank Adams announced his passing this solstice day, December 21, 2020, in Olympia, Washington. We're talking about 2020, the year of reckoning, talking about Hank Adams as being a crucial leader in the reckoning of the legacy of colonialism in the United States. Looks like we do have our first caller. Jackson, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I do believe I fit into this subject matter of extreme hate and discrimination, retaliation. I am a protected class of people. I am transgender. Not by my choosing. I was sexually mutilated by my mother at the age of 5, and I've been paying for that discrimination all of my life. When you talk about systemic racism, that in itself right there has thrown me to the wolves. Right now I'm fighting an eviction for things that I have not done wrong in my residency. It is to throw me out to the wolves to a fight to the death, and the police do not want to stop it. There's extortion involved. I have to go to court to defend myself. No lawyer will help me because of COVID. None of the appointed city positions like aging and disability, my own caseworker, mental health specialist, will not help me.
Well, that sounds like a really incredibly horrible situation you're facing.
Yes, it is. One of which has began in my later years. I am 60 years old. I had to go to work for Walmart to subsidize my income. They dug in my past and found out how and why my sex had been changed. That later got to the police chief in a different state where I resided. He wasn't having it either. I lost a 10-room Victorian home with 60 years of collectibles because he wanted to starve me out. Then I get here to Portland, where I was born on the West Coast, and I have to fight the street because of homelessness, all created by Walmart, which I had been trying to sue for the past 4 years, and they have paid off all the lawyers in that state, and I can't do anything, not even with the EEOC or the Attorney General.
Well, obviously, your story falls, as you said, quite rightly into the reckonings that need to be dealt with. You're certainly at the center of many of the intersectional issues that we're
dealing
with in this culture.
It's not limited to just Native American or Black. It encompasses everyone who's on that plate of discrimination, whatever color you are.
Indeed. Well, I don't have any obviously suggestions specifically.
No, I wasn't looking for that answer. I was just merely putting myself on the line because I'm tired.
I appreciate that.
I'm tired
that, Jack,
of fighting this.
I guess all I was saying was, if anybody listening might have some idea, please contact either my Facebook page or call up the number 503-231-8187. I don't know if you want to, maybe leave your contact information.
Yes, I do. I do indeed.
Okay, when you get off the line, stay on, and I'll have Sonia, the board operator, take that, and then maybe someone has some ideas about how to deal
specifically
with
the eviction
situation.
I would hope so, because I have exhausted all means of asking for help. I'm perplexed. I'm vexed. I have nowhere to go, and I'm alone in this. I'm alone in this world. I am by myself. I have no one.
And that's
no family members,
a situation
no friends.
Facing a lot of people. Obviously, in situations, similar situations created by, exacerbated by the crisis that we're facing. So, yeah, let me just let you go, and you can stay on the line and talk to Sonia for a minute. I appreciate
Certainly.
Your calling in. That takes a lot of courage. I don't know what to tell you other than I hope you find some way out of the situation you're in.
Well, I do too. Courage? No, it's way beyond courage. It's called civil rights.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling, Jackson. Stay
on the
line with Sonia. And I invite other people to call in as soon as they get off the air. 503-231-8187. There's definitely so many stories out there. As I said, I'm in some ways feel a little awkward talking about all this because I really do have it pretty easy. I'm very well buffered here in my own situation. I definitely absorb a lot of the stories of people like Jackson that are happening, and we gotta make some serious changes in this world. So yeah, we're talking about the legacy that we're reckoning with here as 2020 comes to an end. And the fact, as I started out, that there's a lot of talk of 2020 is almost done finally, but obviously we know that what set the stage for 2020 is a long time building, and will take either a long time or some really dramatic events and organizing and mobilizing to at the very least to force the incoming Biden administration and to embolden some of the people the good people have been put into positions, and to challenge the not so good people have been put into administrative positions to make some of the more fundamental changes that, again, Hank Adams and the American Indian Movement in the Trail of Broken Treaties 20-point position paper, which I was reading from, bring up. As well, as I've said, the go back to the Black Panthers 10-point position paper, you know, manifestos from the various liberation movements that grew out of the 1960s and since for feminist liberation, gay liberation, transgender liberation, and all the others, Chicano liberation. And the spirit of the 60s was really alive in that. I don't know if certainly the American Indian Movement wouldn't have been around if there hadn't been for the massive ferment sort of inaugurated by the African-American civil rights movement and the sort of cultural counterculture that bubbled up in the beat movement, the hippie movement, the psychedelic movement, the all the different movements that arose in the 1960s. If you read a lot of the documents coming out of time, it really provided the ability to go further and deeper into looking at a more programmatic attempt to change the institutional systemic injustice of the United States. 503-231-8187, pretty heavy topics. I'd be interested to hear what you have to say. Has anyone not heard of this, of Hank Adams and the 20-point position paper, and just say how interested you are that you've now heard about it and would like to know more? You know, I've occasionally encouraged people to actually read the treaties, including the unratified treaties, of which there were dozens here in the Willamette Valley and in California, that set the stage for the massive colonization of the Willamette Valley by European Americans, and the creation of a virtual white ethno-state that excluded blacks and suppressed Native Americans. The state suppression, oppression of Native Americans has a long history, which is why you read in the 20-point position paper an appeal to federal authorities, very similar to the way in the Black Civil Rights Movement, because of the vicious oppression in the southern and northern states, appealed to the federal government to protect the integration of schools and public transportation and others. And of course, the federal relationship itself is problematic, as you heard in my interview with Steve Newcomb a month or two ago, talking about the doctrine of discovery, which set the stage for the if not legalization, because it was never legal, the normalization or codification of the de facto legalization within an unjust system, the colonization of the United States of the Americas. 503-231-8187. We're already at 8:42 in the morning. We've only had one caller. Love to hear some more people get on the horn at 503-231-8187, or get in touch with me at KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio here on Facebook Land. Looks like we do have another caller. LJ, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Good. Thanks for the show. All right. So now that President Biden has selected Deb Haaland to be Secretary of the Interior, is that going to make everything all better?
Well, I guess I always have to proviso. I maybe didn't say at the outset, I am not Native American. I have no connections other than, you know, personally with indigenous communities, peoples,
yeah,
nations. So I'm just basically riffing off of what, you know, Hank Adams having died and the work that he did, and sort of just reading some of the voices themselves. But, well, she's, you know, first of all, she has to be ratified, which is not a given. A lot of it obviously depends on the races in Georgia, I think. I don't know, really know exactly if anybody's really even looked at how the possible composition of the Senate, you know, will favor or disfavor any particular nomination or all of Biden's nominations. So that's a big question mark right there. Obviously, you know, any particular person in a cabinet position has, you know, a lot of influence and ability to change things within their department and, you know, on the ground for, you know, people. But, you know, if she does, I think, you know, she's very well aware, I think, of everything that I've been talking about. You know, she went to Standing Rock to actually cook for people. She was there, I don't know how long.
Yeah, but she was.
From what I can see, she's, you know, of the people, by the people, for the people, and not just her own native indigenous people. I think she has a pretty acute sense of things. So, yeah, I think she can, you know, she can certainly start to undo a lot of the damage that was done within the Trump administration in the Interior Department. And, you know, I don't know. I don't exactly know what the possibilities are, but I think it's very encouraging. I think certainly Indian country, Native people themselves, I've been reading a lot of reactions. They're very heartened by this appointment. Obviously, she can't, you know, herself undo, you know, whatever, how many hundreds of years of colonization, but it's definitely a point of departure.
Just to remind you and the listening audience, the United States has yet to live up to one treaty it ever signed with any indigenous people. They have never lived up to one treaty. The United States.
Right. Well, that's where. Did you listen to the 20-point proposal?
Signed. I'm sorry.
No. Did you read? Did you listen? Were you listening to the American Indian Movement's 20-point proposal? That where it talks about how to address those questions specifically. I think, I think people really need to read that document, which I've linked to on my KBO.fm program page. Don't listen to me. I think it'd be really helpful in general, and not just that, many other, you know, people need to, you know, really look at this history. We need to do the work to understand the real history and understand the work that's been done already to actually see a way out of it. So, yeah, I think you're right. But we got another caller.
Anyway, have a happy new year. See you guys. Yeah. The cable audience. And keep on keeping on, Paul.
Right on, LJ. I'm not, you know, this happiness. We'll see. We'll see what. I'll be happy if the Biden administration lives up to a minimum of what a lot of people are hoping that it can accomplish in the very dreary context that we're in. But we got another caller. Lee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thankfully, the days are getting longer. So in a celestial sense, Happy New Year. I think that... if we're going to live, if we're going to survive as a species, we're going to really have to, you know, change the way we think and what we prioritize. We're going to have to learn to differentiate between what we need and what we want. And I think that only with a change of mentality that's going to come about, and I don't know how that's possible given the control of corporate mass media
Well, as I always say, I think it's a dialectical process. Changing mentality and changing systems goes hand in hand. They work together dialectically.
I agree, but you know, somehow we have to change that mentality. We have to change our culture so that, you know, we recognize and change, you know, our priorities and those things that are important, not just for ourselves, but given the existential threat to humanity, we're going to have to start considering future generations.
Well, do you have any particular suggestions? I suggested reading the 20-point program as one starting point.
Well, there's so many things to read, and as soon as you start reading, then you're getting away from corporate-controlled mass media.
Right now, I'm
reading Les Payne's book, The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. And it is absolutely astounding to me that the discrimination and abuse of African-American individuals and communities that existed 100 years ago is still persisting.
And, indeed.
And it's just so obvious, and yet, you know, through all the attempts of the civil rights movement and changes in the laws, supposedly, the discrimination still continues.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. We got another call on the line. Obviously, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests of the past year and previously, and the anti-prison industrial complex movement and others, you know, have been working at this for a long time and will continue to work. And the more people can join their efforts, I think the better. So for sure, I thank you for calling, Lee. We got Bill up next, 503-231-8187. We only got 10 minutes left. What do you got to say, Bill?
Me? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, one, I'd like to unwind some now new revisionist hippie history. One, we did not bubble up. Two, the beat, hippie, and psychedelic movements or vibes were not one thing, but they did probably build on one another. There was also Nature Boys in the 50s, which could have been called hippies, but this is even worse. I heard the other day on a show, I can't remember which one it was, but it's people that are probably half my age. I'm 64 years young. And they said that we got to be careful because we don't want our movement to go where the hippies did in the 60s, where they all voted for Reagan in the 80s. No hippie in his right brain, artistic mind, would ever vote for Ronnie Ray guns. And didn't.
Okay.
Thank you. So it's like people that weren't even there read something who might have been, but was not in the movement, okay? Was not at Seabrook, New Hampshire, getting beaten, maced, no, okay? But they went and out to help, and then people just repeat it. Oh, that's what happened. You weren't there, you didn't read the papers that were printed then, which a lot of that was garbage too, but, you know, there was other articles. I wish you would also stop saying, like, at the least, or how about one thing? Could we just, instead of working for a better world, could we just work for a best world? We got to change the language. We got all this little minimalistic language, like hope against hope, faith against faith. Could we want love against love? How many more could we do? Pray against prayer? Who knows? Let's see.
Okay, well, listen, Bill, I appreciate what you're saying. We only have a few minutes left. I noticed that Kathy of the Walla Walla tribe is on the stack, and we have had a lot of white men speaking, which is not bad. Always appreciate whoever calls. But I'd just like to give her a chance to talk in the few minutes we have left. Go ahead, Kathy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Thank you for having this memorial on Atwe Hank Adams. We had many great leaders that were in the fish wars, and behind them were their wives, their daughters, their nieces. And they really mentored a lot of people all across Indian country. And one of them is my younger brother, Don Sampson. My brother is now taken over by request of the Walla Walla people, our true name, the Walulapam, to be headman in my father's place. I want to briefly read a letter that he sent to Governor Inslee on December 22nd.
Please.
Columbia River is sacred and must be protected from the methanol plant. The Columbia River is sacred to the Walla Walla Numatilla people since time began. We have fished the waters of the Columbia, gathering food to feed our families and holding our ceremonies along the shore. A frack gas to methanol refinery along the Columbia is a threat to our way of life and should not be permitted. For thousands of years before the first European immigrants came to my homeland, my people lived a prosperous, healthy, free, and happy life along the confluence of the Columbia, Snake, Yakima, and Walla Walla Rivers. We are a thousand generations Walulapums, Native Americans, who for those thousands of years conserved and took care of millions of acres of land, rivers, and air. We were endowed by the Creator, God, to take care of our forests were healthy, our river free-flowing and clean, air was pure. Fish and wildlife, berries and fields, natural medicines were abundant. I dedicated my life and career to protecting our salmon. As executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, the executive director of the chairman of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and now as the climate change project director for the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians in 2015, I served as indigenous representative to the Paris Climate Accord. These experiences have only deepened my belief that we must do more to protect our salmon, fisheries, and the rivers that sustain them. My family are the Walla Walla, the Palouse, the Umatilla. My great-great-great-grandfather, Chief Pio Pio Moxmox, Yellowbird, was a principal negotiator and signer of the 1855 treaty, along with the Umatillas, Cayuse, Yakima, and Nez Perce chiefs. My lineage and leaders in my family were Walla Walla chiefs. My late father also carried the name Pio Pio Moxmox and was chief of the Walla Wallas, as I am now the chief of the Walulapum and Walla Wallas. We lived at many different places along the river. Salmon fisheries were the center of our livelihood and economy. Historically, over 16 million salmon returned to the Columbia River. The Columbia and Snake River salmon fisheries provided our daily food. Thousands of pounds annually were dried and preserved for trade throughout the Northwest. But the most important use of salmon was for sacrament and essence of our native religious ceremonies. As Native people, we were entrusted with an obligation to God to always take care of salmon so that salmon would take care of us. The rivers where salmon live must be healthy for them to survive. Sadly, today, most salmon populations are facing extinction due to industrial development, climate change, and habitat degradation. The methanol plant, by ecology's own analysis, would emit enough greenhouse gases to be a major polluter to the state. To allow a new project like this at a time when we have already experienced so much loss of salmon due to warming global temperatures is unconscionable. We must uphold our obligation to the Creator's gift of salmon. The proposed methanol plant on the shores of our sacred Columbia is a threat to our salmon that we cannot afford and should not be allowed to proceed. Sincerely, Don Sampson, Pio Pio Moxmox, Yellowbird, Chief of the Walulapum and Walla Wallas.
Wow. Kathy, thank you so much. It's good, really good to hear your voice. And those are powerful words. I realize I should really have either you and or Don on this program. It would be really good to get more deeply into that. If that's something that you think might be possible or you might be interested in. Maybe you could maybe stay on the line. We just have a minute left and give. I've actually been trying to get in touch with you in the past couple weeks, and my old contact info doesn't seem to work anymore. Anyway, we don't need to talk about this on the air, but thank you so much, Kathy. We're just about out of time, but if you could either do that or maybe call back the number after 9 o'clock, and thank you.
Mm-hmm. Again, Kasiaya and our family, we mourn this loss of this leader, and we our hands are up to all those people who he touched. Aye, Kasiaya.
Okay, thank you so much, Kathy. Really appreciate it. And that's a very appropriate, fitting end to today's program, which was talking about a time of reckoning. Obviously, the methanol plant proposed on the Columbia River and all the other threats to the salmon are the continuation of the legacy that we've been talking about on the program, and that Hank Adams himself was fighting so hard to stop and to protect the rights of his people and Kathy's and all the other indigenous peoples of the Northwest. So with that, again, thank you, Kathy, and to all who called and to all who listened. This is Paul Rowan signing off with Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye-bye.
Listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
You're listening.